Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program, Very Remote. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, September 8, 2021. The chief of the UN Peacekeeping Department visits Sudan.
I'm grateful that the highest authorities of Sudan expressed appreciation for the role played by the UN mission UNISFA, and we discussed how UNISFA can continue this role.
And UN officials in South Sudan say technology can still help children stay in schools during COVID-19 lockdowns.
We saw also the potential of innovating around the reaching out to children with the use of radio programs. So I think when we talk about digital, we don't necessarily need to talk about an iPhone or an internet.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United Nations Undersecretary for Peacekeeping Operations says the UN stands ready to support the democratic transformation in Sudan and help the Sudanese people realize political stability. Jean-Pierre says the United Nations is concerned about peace and stability in the disputed Abyei region. He says the UN seeks to consult with Sudan's neighboring countries regarding the status of the peacekeeping operation in the area. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
UN Undersecretary General Jean-Pierre Lacroix is visiting Ethiopia, Sudan, and South Sudan this week and is consulting with regional leaders over the status of the United Nations Interim Security Forces in Abyei or UNISFA after Sudan expressed concerns over the current Ethiopian contingent forces in Abyei. Last month, the Sudanese transitional government wrote to the UN Security Council complaining about the presence of Ethiopian forces in the area, saying they should be replaced by other regional forces to continue maintaining security in the area. Speaking to reporters in Khartoum on Tuesday after meeting with General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the head of Sudan Sovereign Council, and other Sudanese officials, Lacroix said the Sudanese government believes Ethiopian forces in Abyei should be replaced in accordance with the new political developments in the area to avoid a conflict of interest.
I'm grateful that the highest authorities of Sudan expressed appreciation for the role played by the UN mission UNISFA, and we discussed how UNISFA can continue this role and how the function of UNISFA can be adapted to the new situation.
The UN official could not confirm if the UN has accepted Sudan's request to replace the Ethiopian forces, saying further consultations are still underway with regional authorities over the matter. Lacroix says the UN's relations with Sudan have improved after the transitional government carried out several political reforms following the revolution that led to the ousting of former President Omar al-Bashir. He says the UN remains committed to supporting the transitional period in Sudan to realize political stability and lasting peace in the country.
The quality of this discussion today confirmed that there is a great relation between Sudan and the United Nations, and I can absolutely confirm that the UN as a whole remains fully committed to supporting Sudan in its transition.
Sudanese Foreign Minister Mariam As-Sadiq Al-Mahdi describes Lacroix's visit as timely as the government works to restore lasting peace in the country, including in Abyei. She says Sudan is uncomfortable with the presence of Ethiopian forces in the disputed region and would like to see the UN Security Council replace them with any other forces from the region.
He wanted to seek the approval among the three countries, Sudan, South Sudan, and Ethiopia, on the smooth transition of these forces to a peacekeeping mission and to agree on a new force from any other regional country who will replace the current Ethiopian forces.
Al-Mahdi says the Sudan government also believes the new peacekeeping mission in Abyei should be enhanced and empowered to carry out development activities in the region so that the civil population is encouraged to return home.
President Al-Burhan and all the Sudanese officials suggested that the new mission's mandate should be involved in providing development projects for local communities by engaging UN institutions from both Sudan and South Sudan through a consensus.
Lacroix commented the improved relations between Sudan and South Sudan and encouraged them to make political decisions to resolve the dispute over Abyei once and for all. Sudan and South Sudan both claim ownership of Abyei area. The 2005 peace agreement, which led to South Sudan's independence from Sudan in 2011, required that both sides work out the final status of the region, but the issue is still unresolved. UNISFA was deployed by the UN Security Council in 2011 after deadly clashes between Juba and Khartoum displaced some 100,000 people. Their mandates include protection of civilians under imminent threat of physical violence. For VOA News, I'm Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Still on UN matters, the deputy country representative for the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, in South Sudan is urging officials in the country to collect resources needed to reignite learning in order to combat the threats posed by COVID-19. Today is the International Literacy Day, and the UN official says there is a need for innovation in the digital space to promote literacy and overcome the impact of COVID-19-related lockdowns. For VOA News, Sheila Pony reports from Juba.
Ronyo Charles John, a teacher at the Juba Diocese Secondary School, says COVID-19 has caused school attendance to drop significantly this year.
Some students have been restricted to go to school because of the fear of COVID-19. The message that I'm just sending outside there about literacy is that education is the first priority for everybody. You cannot stay there at home without achieving education and you think that you'll be a perfect person tomorrow. Education is a platform that sets you to be a very good person, a prosperous, prominent person tomorrow.
The theme for this year's International Literacy Day is Literacy for Human-Centered Recovery, Narrowing the Digital Divide. This year's commemoration highlights the role literacy can play in building a solid foundation for a human-centered recovery, with a special focus on the interplay of literacy and digital skills required by non-literate youth and adults. Jesper Muller, the deputy country representative for UNICEF in South Sudan, says during this time of a global pandemic, being innovative is the key.
We saw also the potential of innovating around the reaching out to children with the use of radio program. So I think when we talk about digital, we don't necessarily need to talk about an iPhone or an internet, or we can innovate within the space that we and the context that we operate in.
South Sudan's Ministry for General Education and Instructions has initiated interactive radio instructions as one of the country's alternative education systems. Noel Kana, a mathematics teacher of Juba Secondary School, delivers his lessons on the radio. But Kana acknowledges that using alternative methods to reach students can be a challenge.
During the pandemic, we have been helping out our learners in teaching through radios. And the turn-up is okay, but to the rural areas, it's a bit difficult because of some radios are not, it's not covering up to that end. And the interaction of the learners is that okay, but there is a difficulty that because when teaching through radio, there is a very big difference than teaching in the class. Like for me, I was been teaching mathematics for secondary 1, 2, 3, and 4. And even me as a teacher, I'm getting difficulties in some operations working it on radio. It is becoming very difficult.
Kana says the toughest part of virtual learning is finding enough time to teach the lesson.
We are given like 20 to 25 minutes, which is not enough totally. Sometimes you will be ending up teaching one topic in 2 weeks, so it is also a challenge. And then sometimes the lines are not that good. There will be no interaction from the learners.
A number of students who spoke at Juba Dyerson Secondary School described the role literacy has played in their lives and communities.
My name is Isaac Duarte. Right now we have people who want to become doctors. We have people who want to become engineers and all these different professions. And we also know that they are not doing that for themselves but for the community.
My name is Suke Jimodi, and I'm a senior four student. I've discovered that those who haven't gone to school, you know, they have a different way of judging matters. You know, even like coming to serious things affecting our country, like tribalism and all this. You know, it's all about when you haven't gotten the access to be learned, to know that, you know, the country is all about different people contributing to it. You know, your brain is confined to thinking that it's only your village or your clan members that can do something good for you. But when we come to school, when we get exposed to education, we discover that we meet people from different tribes, and we find out that we work together and we contribute, and things become better.
My name is Elizabeth Agbiltau. Literacy is the ability to read and write. In its definition, we could easily see that without literacy, the world would have been a miserable place.
International Literacy Day was established by UNESCO in 1966 to focus attention on efforts to create more literate societies. For VOA News, I am Sheila Aponi in Juba.
From Juba, we moved to Ethiopia, where the World Food Program says the emergency food needs in northern Ethiopia are increasing as conflict spills beyond the embattled Tigray region into neighboring Afar and Amhara provinces. For VOA News, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The agency reports that up to 7 million people are acutely short of food and are facing a hunger crisis. They include more than 5.2 million people in Tigray who are dependent on UN food aid for survival. Additionally, the World Food Program reports the conflict, which has now engulfed the entire region, has thrust 1.7 million more people into hunger. This month, WFP has begun delivering emergency food assistance to communities in Ethiopia's northern region and says it plans to reach 530,000 people in Afar and 250,000 in Amhara with food aid. Meanwhile, in Tigray, WFP spokesman Thompson Fieri says the situation continues to deteriorate. He says aid agencies are struggling to meet the urgent food needs of more than 5 million people across the war-torn region.
In fact, WFP food stocks had been almost entirely depleted until 2 days ago when the first convoy in over 2 weeks entered the region. The WFP-led convoy of over 100 trucks carried 3,500 metric tons of food and other life-saving cargo, including fuel, as well as health and shelter items.
Fieri says WFP has only managed to get 355 trucks into the region since mid-July. While this sounds like much, he says it is not. He says 355 trucks represents less than 10% of the supplies needed. He says 100 trucks must enter Tigray every day to meet people's food requirements. He says trucks get stuck in Afar because of bureaucratic delays and difficulties in passing checkpoints. He says some trucks also have been attacked and looted by people in local communities.
Aside from the escalating fighting that is in the north of the country, food security for millions across the whole of Ethiopia is also under threat due to an unprecedented funding gap for WFP activities in the country.
WFP is calling for $426 million to expand its emergency food operations to meet the needs of up to 12 million people throughout Ethiopia this year. The agency warns it will be forced to cut rations for people in northern Ethiopia if it does not receive the extra funding. It says it might have to stop distributing food to about 4 million people in Tigray, Afar, and Amhara in the coming months if it runs out of money. November 4th will mark a year since the Ethiopian government began its military offensive to wrest control of the Tigray region from the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, Malawi Disability Show goes on. That story's lineup for you right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what steps should the government take to ensure children are enrolled and stay in school?
I think governments should get more facilities in the schools, like library, and also to get them a playing ground. Because as the child learns, they have to play to release stress.
There has to be a conducive learning atmosphere, which of course we lack in most of our government schools.
Government should provide free education for the people in the village, as well as in town also.
Government should provide free meals for kids when they go to school. They should also provide good learning environment. They should also provide qualified teachers who would also take care of the children and keep them engaged so they'll be interested in schooling.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Disabled fashion designers have long struggled against discrimination, especially in developing countries such as Malawi. To combat the problem, Malawian fashion brand House of Exandria on Saturday organized the country's first fashion show for people with disabilities. For VOA News, Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
21-year-old Ruth Kirwa went into fashion and design industry 4 years ago after her dream to become a pilot failed.
Because at that time I had no school fees for a piloting course. What the well-wisher could manage at that time was to pay me for a fashion and design course. I had no option, and when I started, it was not that easy for me.
Kirwa, who now owns the fashion brand Opis Designs in Nzuzu, a city in North Malawi, says discrimination has kept her from gaining more customers and promoting her designs.
People look down on me.
They think I cannot make nice outfits. They think because I am disabled, I cannot manage what they want. So it has really affected me. And as a result, this has affected exposure of my products.
She recalls an incident when a potential customer who was attracted to an outfit worn by her friend refrained from buying after noticing that Kirwa, who made the outfit, was disabled.
So by the time they just came,
so when she entered my shop and saw me, she was seemingly very disappointed and did not expect that I was the one who made the outfits. She was disappointed with my physical appearance and returned without pressing any order.
Though disappointed, Kirwa did not give up. On Saturday, she was among 60 participants at Malawi's first fashion show for people with disabilities, which the House of Xandria, a Malawian fashion brand, organized in Blantyre. Organizers said the All Shades of Beautiful show was aimed to address some of the challenges people with disabilities in Malawi face in exposing their talents and creativity.
So I thought, okay, let me create a platform and give these people a chance to show people that having a disability is not having an inability, but they're also able to do amazing things, even more than what other people can do as well.
And plans are being made to help them sell their outfits without fear of discrimination.
And in the long run, we want to create a hub where all these people can bring their things to that hub and people can come through and see and buy. And we already have a market, so we are creating that market for them so they don't have to go through the struggle of finding customers. Advertising would do all that for them.
People with disabilities make up 11% of the Malawi population, according to the country's 2018 census. But many of them are ultra-poor, largely because of discrimination in employment. Many complain they cannot get help from money-lending institutions because of their appearance. The Malawi government says it is working to address that.
We have the cash transfer program, which we also focus very much on the chiefs to make sure that when they are retargeting, they've got not to leave persons with a disability. Because sometimes at a village level, they let them down without even retargeting them.
Gariati said the government has also asked money-lending institutions to prioritize entrepreneurs with disabilities like Chirwa and to promote their businesses. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Still in Southern Africa, a new national study has found out that South Africa's school dropout rate has tripled following disruptions to education brought by the pandemic. Educators and non-profits are now racing to intervene and encourage young people to re-enroll in schools. From Johannesburg, Linda Giftash reports.
Kabelo Ramanwane did not return to his rural high school north of Pretoria when classes reopened after pandemic lockdowns. The 16-year-old got used to spending his days at home. With limited access to technology, online learning was impossible and he quickly fell behind. Child and youth care workers like Marie Van Royen, who provide support to students at his school, say he's among many who felt too discouraged to come back.
It's hard for them to catch up. When I speak to the learners, they tell me that it's overwhelming. So some of them, they feel demotivated to come back to school or to come to school also. They're saying it's too much work because of the pandemic.
A national study on the effects of the pandemic in South Africa found that 500,000 students dropped out of school by May of this year. That's compared to 230,000 dropouts in 2018. Experts say not graduating increases children's likelihood to join gangs, use drugs, be abused, or become pregnant. Rahima Esop is the head of communications and advocacy for South Africa's Zero Dropout campaign.
We know that learners who drop out of school before completing the final year of high school, known as matric here in South Africa, struggle to find decent jobs. Dropout isn't just the problem of the individual or the individual's family or community. Dropout is a problem that affects the country as a whole, as well as the economic health of the country.
The Zero Dropout campaign says just one adult taking interest in a child's education can turn things around. The Izabindi Ezekweleni program is attempting to do that by providing 29 schools with child and youth care workers. Care providers offer students education and social support in the class, at home, and during lockdowns, by phone. Timbandi Yende is a child and youth care worker and mentor for the program.
We also identify those who have dropped out, advocate for them at school, make sure that they are reintegrated, given support in terms of catching up. We also help them with the transition to adulthood in terms of assisting them in applying for tertiary and getting them into different programs.
Ramanwane was among the students identified by the program and linked with a care worker.
She's the one that told me that I must go back to the school. Yeah, that's why I did go back to the school.
The Zero Dropout campaign and its partners are calling on the government to launch a nationwide strategy to re-enroll and retain students. They also want to see better attendance record keeping so schools can track and trace absenteeism to identify at-risk students before they drop out. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
As South Africa prepares for a fourth wave of COVID-19, there are growing calls for the government to make vaccination mandatory. But the calls are opposed by a loud anti-vaxxer lobby group. These are people who, for a variety of reasons, don't believe in immunizing people during one of the deadliest pandemics in history. South Africa is Africa's hardest hit country by COVID-19, having registered almost 3 million cases and about 84,000 deaths. For VOA News, Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
The South African Committee of Health Sciences Deans is on a long list of organizations that want citizens to, in effect, be forced to take the jab. Chairman Professor Tian de Jager says there's enough scientific evidence to prove the vaccines are safe and effective. He says the state should start with mandatory vaccinations in any and all healthcare facilities.
It is critical to get students, doctors, any staff working in a health setting vaccinated to make sure that we not putting the patients at risk or anybody in any environment.
Calls such as the Jager's come on the back of research by one of South Africa's biggest public hospitals, Grote Skier in Cape Town. Operations Chief for the Health Department, Dr. Sadiq Karim, says the study concentrated on patients admitted with serious COVID-19.
On the day that they did the survey, of the 156 people admitted to Groeske Hospital with COVID, in fact, they found that 153 people were unvaccinated. Of those who were admitted into the intensive care, of the 66, they found that all of them were, in fact, unvaccinated. Of the 32 people on ventilators, all of them were, again, unvaccinated. So I think it sends a really important, really powerful message.
But the anti-vaxxers have dismissed the study as lies and continue to encourage people not to take vaccines. Their reasons for doing so include that COVID-19 is a hoax designed to enrich pharmaceutical companies and that vaccines make people infertile. The anti-vaxxer movement is particularly strong in the Western Cape province, where Karim's based.
I mean, as medical practitioners, we are obviously equally frustrated in the province that people just don't listen to the science of it, that they believe all kinds of conspiracy theories, and a lot of that misinformation can be combated, and that's why the colleagues from Groeske Hospital, in fact, put out that graphic that so visibly displays to people and proves to people what the benefits of vaccination are.
De Jager says those refusing to be immunized have no excuse for their stance because it's not based on scientific evidence and is extremely selfish.
We need to do the responsible thing. If you're not vaccinated and you go to the doctors, obviously you're at higher risk and the chances are much bigger to expose everybody within that practice. And it is basically a measurement to protect other patients as well as the doctor and the healthcare workers working in that facility.
But Karim says the anti-vaxxers won't listen to doctors like him and De Jager because they consider them to be part of the so-called conspiracy. So his department is trying to overcome vaccine hesitancy in other ways.
Whether they be community leaders or whether they be religious leaders, we've been using trusted voices to try and get the scientific message across to people, because it's quite clear that as medical practitioners, we are not having the impact that we would have desired and wanted to have.
The government says at this stage it won't force anyone to take the jab, and it remains the right of every citizen to choose whether to be vaccinated. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
We love to hear what you think about the issues in our news. Our WhatsApp number is +12026308011. We reserve the rights to read your brief messages every Friday. That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday. We now leave you with Emmanuel Kembe and the song Zamankuru Juja, which means it's time for cultivation.
Samantha Kuru Juja, Samantha Kuru Juja, Waladi, Samantha Kuru Juja, Yuma, Samantha Kuru Juja, Titi.
We've been listening to Emmanuel Kembe and the song Zaman Kuru Juja. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for allowing us into your phones, homes, and vehicles. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.